Dozens of women veterans are running for office. Will this be the year of the military woman?
You have the first generation of combat veterans who are female.
The mission of the Naval Academy, which includes the words to develop leaders for the highest positions of command.
I think what it's taught me as far as leadership is just how important a diversity of opinions is, how important it is to build bridges to people with different ideas and different backgrounds.
We all have this inner response. You have a tough job, an impossible mission, send me. And that's why I think you see veterans raising their hand.
We'll examine this year's wave of women who want to continue their service to the country. I'm Amy Walter. This is The Takeaway. When you think of the current political atmosphere in the U.S. these days, how many of you are feeling a little something like this?
You look around today and you say, you know, where are the values? Where's the integrity? Where's the personal courage, the selfless service, all of those values we were taught? Ultimately, where is the leadership?
That's Sue Fulton. Today, she serves in New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy's cabinet as the chief administrator of motor vehicles. Back in 1980, she was part of the first graduating class of women at West Point.
We all have this inner response. You have a tough job, an impossible mission, send me. And we were trained, we were taught to step into that gap. And that's why I think you see veterans raising their hand, stepping in and saying, I want to be part of the government because I want to bring these values that are core to me, that are central to my service, back to the leadership of this country.
And Sue's right. A lot of vets have raised their hands. They're running for political office this year, and a lot of them happen to be women.
There are 32 veterans, House and Senate, who have filed. 23 of them are Democrats, 9 are Republicans. To date, 11 of those have won their primary, 8 have lost their primary, and 13 are still in the running. Their primary is pending.
Debbie Walsh is the director of the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University. If some are calling this year's midterms the year of the woman, a sub-story might be it's the year of the military woman. Debbie Walsh again.
You know, right now there are only 4 women who serve in Congress who are veterans, and there's a lot of opportunity here to see some growth in that number.
So it's more than likely we will see a doubling of the women in Congress who are veterans.
It's possible. But I think what we're seeing in this year with the number of women who are running who are veterans is, I would predict, the beginning of a change. We are seeing more women in the military, more women who have combat military experience, but more women who are military veterans. And it is a powerful part of their resume for women as candidates, because I think one of the things that's often held against women is that they may not be tough enough or strong enough for elective office. And I think when you are a veteran, it is very hard to argue that you don't have the strength of character or the leadership abilities to serve in Congress. If you've been tough enough to serve in Iraq or in Afghanistan in the military, I think while Congress may be a tough place, I think they're well-equipped to handle what comes at them. It also gives them a credibility around defense issues, security issues, that women have been underestimated in the past. In many ways, it's a bit of a leveler for women as a credential for them to serve. I think it gives them a gravitas that men have been given as candidates. There's a respect that veterans deserve, and that women have not been able to take advantage of in the past.
Now, we're seeing a lot of the women who are running as veterans are Democrats. Part of that is because there simply are a lot more Republican seats open, so Democratic challengers, Democratic opportunities. But is there another reason that you see that there are more women who are veterans running as Democrats? We think of the military, or at least I think of the military, as producing folks who may be more conservative in their political ideology.
Yeah, so overall, women are more likely to be Democrats. If you look at the elected officials around the country, women who serve as elected officials are more likely to be Democrats. For instance, in Congress, women make up about a third of the Democratic caucus and only about 10% of the Republican caucus. So there's a disparity right off the bat. I think that a part of what we are seeing this year, not just among veterans, but women in general who are running, they are disproportionately Democrats. Right now, we've seen 476 women who have filed for the U.S. House. 352 of them are Democrats. So this is this surge that's being talked about is largely on the Democratic side. And I think it has largely come from a reaction to the election of Donald Trump, feeling that elections have real consequences, a sense that the issues and the policy concerns that matter to women are in jeopardy and that they need to run for office. Right now, that energy and that enthusiasm and that sense of really wanting to get more engaged in the political system and be that candidate and be on the inside is largely on the Democratic side. And we're seeing it among the veterans just the way we are seeing it across the board with women candidates.
Throughout American history, we've placed a lot of value on military service in our political leaders. Every president who served between 1945 and 1993 had also served in the military. Historically, it helped male candidates earn credibility with voters and demonstrate their patriotism and leadership. And that makes sense, because it was primarily men who served. But that's changing. Sue Fulton, who we heard from earlier, was part of the first female class of West Point graduates.
For me, West Point was a shining city on a hill. The opportunity to be at West Point, to be a member of the Corps of Cadets, was an honor that never faded with time. Our commitment to serve our country, the reason that we're here at the Military Academy, is something that is essential to who we are as a country. That it's essential that we carry forward the most important American values, that we be not only that we be leaders, but that we be selfless servants. That ideal of service is drilled into you so that honor and integrity are always at the forefront.
And what were the expectations for Sue as one of the first women at the Military Academy?
The first class of women showed up on July 7th, 1980. And I believe that the expectation of a good number, if not the majority, of cadets and officers who were already at West Point was that none of us would last out the summer. I remember at the end of the summer when the rest of the Corps comes back for the academic year, there was genuine astonishment among many of them that there were still women cadets at the academy. So I think there was a strong sense that we didn't belong there, that we wouldn't be able to hack it, that we wouldn't have the strength. That expectation only affected me in the sense that I was bound to overcome it. I've often told people when they say, hey, what were the first women like, or what was that first class like? And I will tell you, the key element of succeeding in that first class of women was stubbornness. Those of us who were stubborn enough to overcome the obstacles, to absolutely refuse to be deterred, to absolutely refuse to be bullied, that's how we made it.
And when I look at the gap between when you graduated and now thinking about the women that are running for Congress, Mikey Sherrill and others from the Naval Academy who graduated in the mid-90s, why do you think it's now that they're doing that? You talked a lot about, you know, this is inculcated in you when you're in the military, this idea of service and giving back and leadership. And it's now that we're seeing so many of these women who have that experience really jump into politics. Why has it not been earlier? Why didn't we see this in the 90s or earlier in the 2000s?
Well, I think we're in a crisis. I think that this country today is in crisis. People refer to them as norms of our politics and the way that our political leaders act and the way that they speak, and the way that they respect other Americans. Those so-called norms are being shattered. I would say they're values. Our values are being shattered. The notion that if you have a political office of responsibility, you do not lie to your constituents. You do not lie to the American people. That you do not cheat. That you do not steal. Those core values are being shattered in front of our eyes. You know, as I've always said, you know, if you are going to be a successful woman in the U.S. Armed Forces, you cannot be deterred by obstacles. You know, you cannot be disillusioned by the odds. You have to be willing to fight for what you believe in, regardless of what's in front of you. And when there's a crisis like we have today, I believe that it's not surprising at all that women veterans are stepping up into that gap, because that's what we do.
Sue Fulton says it's no surprise women vets are stepping up. It's a core part of their military training. But is something else going on here?
So I think there's two things going on.
That's Senator Tammy Duckworth, a Democrat from Illinois and a retired U.S. Army lieutenant colonel. She served in the Iraq War and lost both her legs in combat.
One is a demographic shift where you see the military changing with the retirement of the Vietnam generation and sort of the older generation. What we have now in the military is a much more progressive military in many ways. People sort of think the military is very conservative, but it's actually become much more progressive. So you have, for example, a military now that have officers who for their entire career serve with LGBTQ colleagues. And that's where I think you see a much more democratic leaning former military running for office. As far as the women are concerned, you have the first generation of combat veterans who are female, who are now coming out of that.
When that really started, was that in the early 90s when women were allowed to fly in combat missions?
Yes, 1993 was when the decision was made. And so we now have, and this I think is a very normal thing that's happened in the past, we now have the first generation of female combat veterans who are now parlaying that background into runs for office. This is something the men have been doing from George Washington to, you know, Vietnam veterans came home from Vietnam and they ran for office. And so it's been something that men have been doing for a long time. It's just that the reason you're seeing the first group of women is because this is the first group with combat experience.
What does combat experience give you that you couldn't get by serving in another role in the military?
I think it's a confidence and an understanding of how to stick to the mission and the priorities. And I think that once you have that combat experience under your belt, it also lends, for better or worse, a greater legitimacy to the population. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, for me, running for office, for example, starting from 2006, the fact that I was a combat vet lent a legitimacy to my standing on national security issues, issues that maybe Democrats have been seen as weak on in the past. But when you have a combat vet standing there and a female combat vet, you don't get the same dings as you would have had you not had that experience.
And are these women who are running, are they reaching out to you and or have you been recruiting any of them to come to run?
Yeah. A little bit of both. I seem to be the person that women pilots reach out to. So I've been hearing extensively from women pilots, including ones that are still serving in the military, who have called me up and said, I'd like to run in 2020. I'd like to run in 2022. What do I need to do now as I wrap up my military career or as I get to a point where I'm getting to the end of my 6-year term or whatever? And so I've been giving them advice. So yes, I am actively recruiting and I am actively being contacted by members who are of the military who think of running, and especially women and especially women pilots. There's a lot of Black Hawk pilots out there.
A lot of Black Hawk pilots out there. What is the kind of advice that you give to somebody? I've talked to many of these candidates. Most of them don't have any political experience. What advice do you give them, number one, being a candidate, but about being a female candidate?
So I tell them that they will get the attention and the notoriety based on being a female combat veteran or a female pilot, but that they are not going to win elections based on that. That they might be able to get the initial look, but they have to do the hard work of developing the policies and do the hard work of running a real campaign. And that there's no coasting to victories. You can't be a professional hero and get there. So you have to be able to have substance behind what you do. And I say, now listen, if you want to use your military background as a starting point for how you develop policies, for example, if you want to talk about education reform and the need to invest in education and talk about how the Department of Defense has said that 7 out of 10 kids in this country do not qualify to serve in the military because they can't pass the basic math and English tests, then talk about it from those terms and say, this is why we have to invest in education and in public education, because if we want to make our country strong, we can't recruit. But you can't just, you're not going to get elected based on having flown helicopters in combat. And the American people need substance from you. And that's my biggest bit of advice for them is do your homework and get put your head down and develop a platform, develop real ideas, and just get out there and do the legwork of connecting with your constituents.
Coming up, we'll meet two female veterans running for office this political cycle, and we'll find out if they're taking Senator Duckworth's advice. That's up next. Stay with us.
Hey, thanks for checking out the Takeaways podcast. I know there are like hundreds of podcasts out there, so we really appreciate you choosing ours. And if you like what you hear, why not help spread the word? You leaving us a rating or a review on iTunes will definitely help us stand out from the pack. Thanks in advance.
I spent 20 years as a U.S. Marine, flew 89 combat missions bombing Al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
Graduated into flight school in the first class of women eligible for combat and became a Sea King helicopter pilot.
Well, I spent 20 years in the Navy. That experience taught me that you don't live with chaos, you end it.
The toughest fights are what you run towards, not away from.
I absolutely refuse to bow down to Sharia law. After 8 years of fighting, I won my battle for the religious freedom of American servicewomen.
I didn't fight in Iraq to let the gun lobby flood our streets with weapons like those I used in the Marines, or to let insurance and drug companies bankrupt our families.
I'm running for Congress.
In races that span the country, female veterans are running for office this November, and they're putting their military experience front and center of their campaigns. We asked you, how much does it matter to you if an elected official has military experience?
I think that civic leaders can understand the concerns of the military without having served.
This is Barry Wynn calling from Brighton, Michigan, and my answer is no. In fact, I'm more inclined towards candidates who haven't served in our military.
Yes, I think they should. It gives them a sense of discipline that they will need for running for office.
This is Joan Lith from Illinois. The president should have had military experience, preferably seen combat, so he or she understands the gravity of putting soldiers and sailors into harm's way.
For my next guests, they're hoping their military background will carry weight with their voters. Mikey Sherrill is running for Congress in New Jersey, and Elaine Luria is running in Virginia. They're both Democrats, and both graduated from the Naval Academy in the mid-90s. They're two of the three women Naval Academy graduates running for Congress this year. Amy McGrath, who graduated in Luria's class, is running in Kentucky. She's gotten the most national attention thanks to her kickoff campaign video that went viral.
When I was 13, my congressman told me I couldn't fly in combat. He said Congress thought women ought to be protected and not allowed to serve in combat. I never got a letter back from my Senator Mitch McConnell.
The Naval Academy gives these women a bond.
We text each other with questions. Our staffs talk to each other. Mikey actually popped through town recently, and my husband helped her out to get some Navy paraphernalia while she was here in Norfolk.
Yeah, I was down in Norfolk visiting my old squadron, and Elaine's husband was great, and he couldn't have been more helpful.
And their military experience has instilled in them similar values. Mikey, I'll start with you. Tell us about your experience there. You graduated in 94, so the ban had not been lifted yet. What did that mean for you and your career, and how did it diverge from what men in your class were doing?
By the time I was a senior or first class and did service selection, they were lifting the combat exclusion. So about midway through the year, we all the women in the class were called into an assembly and told, you know, this is how aviation is going to look. And I actually remember a friend of mine saying, well, you know, are they going to open Marine combat jets to women? And the Marine Corps officer said, oh, no, I don't think so. And of course they did. the way they determined billets before I service selected, they would set aside billets for women in some non-combatant aircraft, and then they would set aside billets for men. But as that changed, they put all the billets together, and it was kind of a changing thing going on throughout my senior year. So I was never quite sure, you know, what the numbers would be and if I would be competitive for a flight billet. And even the day I service selected, I was walking up and we had these old monitors back in 94, and the number kept ticking down of flight billets that were available. And I went for it, and I wasn't sure. And I said, you know, I want Navy Air. And they said, okay, you know, Mitchum and Cheryl, you got the second to last billet for Navy Air. And I was kind of shaking because this is, you know, what I'd wanted to do since I was in the fifth grade. So I walk out kind of shaky, and I just remember this older gentleman, like a World War II pilot. He had an old bomber jacket on, and he just kind of slapped me on the back and said, you see that? You work too hard. I remember thinking, oh, my gosh.
What have I gotten myself into, right? How did this experience, you know, that you came in at a time when this was a first for women to be in many of these positions, how do you think this impacted the way you look at leadership now and what you take from that into being, if you're elected, into being a member of Congress?
I think what it's taught me as far as leadership is just how important a diversity of opinions is, how important it is to build bridges to people with different ideas and different backgrounds. I know that from my experience, when I had a commanding officer that truly wanted everyone to succeed and wanted the squadron to succeed, things went incredibly well, you know, including for women. And then when I had a commanding officer that wasn't invested in having women in his squadron and didn't want to promote certain members of the squadron, that, you know, good order and discipline really broke down.
What about you, Elaine, and what it taught you about leadership and being in the role that you're in right now as a political candidate and potentially a member of Congress? How has this shaped the way you look at leading and being part of this different kind of mission?
Well, I think, you know, we're highlighting the fact that the military is very mission driven, and, you know, serving on ships and having done 6 deployments in that capacity, there was varied composition of those crews. So I mentioned the first destroyer I served on out of Japan, there were only 4 officers and 3 chief petty officers on the entire ship of about 300 people who were women. Then at nuclear power school, I was the only female officer in my nuclear power school class. And then going to the Harry S. Truman, there really were not any enlisted women in the, you know, rates that related to, you know, operating the reactors and reactor department. But then later on in my career as a department head on a destroyer again, we had a large number of women. And there was just definitely a dynamic that you could see with more women in the organization, with more diversity, with more viewpoints, that the organization became stronger. And like Mikey said, that, you know, when the chain of command valued that diversity and really used it to their advantage, it made us accomplish our mission better and more efficiently. And, you know, I think that, you know, in Congress, there are not as many women as there are in our general population. And the closer we get to the people representing our country, looking like our country, as makeup based off of not only gender, but, you know, other factors, you know, such as race, religion, sexual orientation. I would love to see a much broader diversity representing us.
I want you to think back to the 2016 election and the ways in which you saw Hillary Clinton as a candidate be treated as the first female running for president. In your own way, you were breaking down some barriers. What did you take away from that? And did that experience impact the way that you see yourself now as a political figure?
I'd have to say that, you know, looking from afar, I think that there were people who, you know, just had biases in general going into the election last year, and that potentially they weren't going to say anything favorable, whether the candidate, you know, the particular candidate we're talking about, Hillary Clinton, as a woman, and they just use that as fuel for the fire. But I kind of just want to throw in some personal experiences, because there's a lot of things that have happened on the campaign trail with me that I never really anticipated. You know, we've talked about our military background, so you don't really put a lot of mascara or eyeliner on in the morning with your coveralls and your steel-toed boots to go operate nuclear reactors. It's just kind of not part of your daily routine. And so, you know, the comments that I'll get from people, you know, via social media or our website, you need to wear more makeup, then you need to wear less makeup. And then people say, well, I don't really vote this way, but some people do. You need a makeover. You know, so those kind of things. And, you know, I just anticipate that, you know, some male candidates don't get comments on their clothes. Like, you wore that blazer 2 weeks ago on Thursday. And I noticed, you know, those types of things, you know, just go unnoticed potentially for male candidates. But certainly in no way an obstacle. It's just interesting to see what people notice and what people value. But I really just try to focus on, let's talk about the issues and not my mascara.
And Mikey, tell me how you came to your decision to run for Congress. I mean, it seems to me you had a pretty nice life. You have young kids, you're a prosecutor, and now you're putting yourself into politics for the very first time. Why now?
I think as someone who's always served her country, I went to the Naval Academy, and then I was in the Navy for almost 10 years as a helicopter pilot, and then in my final tour as a Russian policy officer, and then serving again here at home at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Newark, I really felt called upon to serve again, and I thought the best way I could do that was to run for Congress, because as a mother of four kids, I'm incredibly invested in the future of this country. And we have so many things on the table that we really need to take a critical look at. What does the future of work look like? What is our role in the international economy? What is our role as a global leader and fighting for democracy? And how are we going to treat our traditional allies? What really spurred me to run was the fact that my representative was refusing to hold town hall meetings. And in a changing time like this, when there are so many issues on the table that we need to address, to have our representative in Congress refuse to meet with us, refuse to discuss the issues that he's legislating on, was offensive to my notions of democracy. And that was the particular point when I decided to run for Congress.
Elaine, what about you?
Well, I think back to my first day at the Naval Academy, and I'm sure, Mike, you remember, among many other things that we have to memorize is the mission of the Naval Academy, which includes the words, to develop leaders for the highest positions of command, citizenship, and government. And so I had in the back of my mind, you know, an expectation, a personal expectation to continue to serve in other ways after my military career. And I felt in our current political environment, something very similar to what she said is that, you know, my representative not only hasn't done town halls, at this point, I think it's 525 days. So very shortly after he was sworn into his first term, and those didn't go too well for him. So he's basically said flat out that it's not my job. And along those lines as well, you know, there's many votes that he's taken that I don't think are in the interest of our district. And those include, you know, removing access to quality, affordable health care, votes that are, you know, bad for the environment. And so all of those things and all those votes put together that I really think are not in the best interest of the people of our district or in our national defense, it just made me say I need to step up and run. So what I had felt as an expectation to serve felt like an obligation in our current climate. So that's what drove me to make the decision to run this year.
You both know that there are now more women veterans running than any time since people have been keeping track of such things. Is this just a coincidence that just all happened to come together at this point in time, or is something else going on, do you think? Elaine?
I think there is this drive of people who've served their country to continue that service, people who feel responsible for the country. We've all taken numerous oaths to the Constitution of the United States. We've always put this country first. And it just seems like a natural outgrowth of that service to continue our service by running for Congress. I'll tell you something that, you know, I love is how many Naval Academy women are running. I have to say that I was at an event in my community and someone stood up and said, you know, we have the opportunity to elect the first female graduate of the Naval Academy to Congress. And I said, this country doesn't just have the opportunity to elect one, it has the opportunity to elect three. So I don't know what was in the water in the 90s, but, you know, I think that the number of veterans running and the number of women running, I think it comes together in such a great way with women veterans because we've all put this country first. And as women, we realize how important it is to fight for our values and to leave a better place for our children. And so I think about how both groups to me feel like very proactive groups.
I talked to one of those women, and Mikey, I know you know her, Sue Fulton, who was in that first class of women at the military academy. And mm-hmm. What she thought too was for so many women and other veterans who are running this year, what really spurred them to action was this idea about just in our political climate right now and politics in general, that the integrity and the leadership and the values that you all had taken at the academy is, it's not there anymore. There's a vacuum. Do you agree with that sentiment, that it's a way to say, I don't like the direction that this country is taking in terms of its leadership and its integrity, its values?
You know, I think Sue raises a great point. A lot of us are just concerned about the level of discourse in this country. And I'll tell you, I hear over and over again that people in my district, they just want Congress to work again. They want people in Congress to work together. For too many of us, it feels like people in Congress spend more time fighting each other than fighting for this country and the future of this country. And I laugh because I always tell a story. I say, you know, when I was a helicopter pilot, I never started missions by saying, okay, you know, as the helicopter aircraft commander here, I'm only taking Republicans on this mission, or I'm only taking Democrats on this mission. I kind of laugh when I think of what my commanding officer would have said if I told him or her, you know, I can't fly with Republicans. I mean, that would have, you know, that just never would have happened. We all work together. We work with people from all over this country with different backgrounds, with different values. But we always knew that we all care deeply about this country and we're going to work together to get the mission accomplished. And I think that's something that I hear over and over again from my community. People want new leadership and they want bipartisanship in our Congress.
Elaine, how much of your time as you're talking to folks, how much is your military experience the centerpiece of your campaign versus other stuff? Like how do you use and talk about your military background vis-a-vis the other things that you're talking about in the campaign and the issues going on in your district?
Well, I think, you know, talking to an audience, like this morning I spoke to a Kiwanis club, and you know, going in, you always want to provide an introduction and you want to provide a background, and I think that sort of providing your life experiences is a way to show what your values are. And I think showing that I served in the military for 20 years, that, you know, sets an expectation, like we've talked about. I took the oath to support and defend the Constitution. I deployed 6 times to the Middle East and Western Pacific. So those are dangerous situations. And I've literally been in situations where we, you know, are dangerous and people are putting their life on the line to defend our country. So I think just saying that you served in the military for 20 years, it lays a groundwork for people understanding your values and that you're willing to serve and willing to sacrifice. And you know, I also talk frequently about my small business, which has really tied me to the community and has taught me a lot. You know, when you have a business where you have to, you know, make a payroll and people are depending on you, and kind of understanding the ins and outs of, you know, people's livelihood depending on the business that you're running. So talking about those things as well as being a mother. I mean, everyone out there with children knows that it's difficult to do all these things and juggle all that while raising a 9-year-old. So, you know, I really try to focus on all three of those things because I think that those are really kind of the core things that make up who I am professionally and, you know, personally as a mother and a wife. And I think highlighting all three of them is important for people to really understand the picture of what I've done in my life and what I can bring to Congress. And, you know, it shows what my values are because that's how I've spent my life.
Hmm. Mikey, what about you?
It's interesting. I do, you know, like Elaine said, it's interesting she said that because I have kind of the three-pronged bio, which in my case is my military service as a helicopter pilot and a Russian policy officer, and then my service as a federal prosecutor here in New Jersey, and then being a mother. And I agree with her. That kind of gives people a sense of your values, a sense of the fact that when you say you've always put this country first and you intend to continue to do so, that you've put your money where your mouth is, that you've done that. And then I pivot to the issues of the district with taxes and healthcare and infrastructure. But that initial bio of service and being a veteran, that I think gives people a kind of opens their minds to listen to then the follow-on things without some of the cynicism we see so many times when we hear people say they're going to do stuff in a difficult environment. Because let's face it, right now Washington's a very difficult environment. And so to show people that, you know, you really do want to go make change there and you really do want to go put this country first, I think it's important to have that background to show people that that's what you've always done.
These candidates are feeling optimistic that they can get into Congress and work across the aisle. And perhaps there's a little bit of naivete there. But they've already managed to do something maybe even more challenging than uniting Republicans and Democrats. These Naval Academy women got a West Point grad to get behind them. Sue Fulton again from earlier in the hour.
It's crazy. I did at one of her events, when she mentioned graduating from the Naval Academy, a public event, I actually booed her, which she called out in the discussion. But I have been known, in support of Mikey Sherrill and Amy McGrath, I have been known to say, it's killing me, but at this moment, I will say go Navy. It was painful.
And that might just be the hardest of rivalries to overcome. And next week, I'll be taking the day off, but my colleague Tanzina Vega will be hosting the show, and she's looking at why people don't vote. If you're a non-voter by choice or otherwise, we want to hear from you. Why don't you vote? And what could change your decision? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Again, that's 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. I'm Amy Walter. I'll be back with you in 2 weeks. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.